Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman of great intelligence who has brought it to bear happily in the service of her country in a number of capacities, notably as a national security advisor to Senator Ted Cruz and also a deputy national security advisor to President Donald J. Trump, is our first guest. She is a senior fellow, I'm proud to say, these days at the Center for Security Policy. Her name is Dr. Victoria Coates. She has just written an important piece in the Jerusalem Post entitled "The Real Iran Deal Needs to Include All the Relevant Actors." Victoria, welcome back. It's good to have a chance to talk to you about that and more.
Thank you very much, Frank.
I have a sort of proposition that I'd like to put to you before we get into the point of your piece and the specifics of the Iran deal. It seems as though the context in which this conversation is taking place is a reversion by the Biden-Harris administration to the bad old days of the Obama years, in which it was better to be an enemy of the United States than a friend. The former got treated more favorably than the latter, a formula that I believe pretty demonstrably conduces to having more enemies and fewer friends. Is that too sweeping or too uncharitable a characterization of what we see going on, do you think?
No, I mean, I think you've hit it spot on. I mean, one of the things that really struck me this week was the strike on Natanz, on the Iranian nuclear facility, which either was or was not the Israelis. But what struck me was that the United States came out and very quickly said it wasn't us. We didn't do it. And so immediately distancing ourselves from Israel. And, you know, if it was the Israelis, obviously I would support them in whatever action they think they need to take to protect themselves. But just what concerns me is they're going to have to go it alone right now. And that's a very dangerous spot. And that's where, you know, since we're not engaged, you can have unintended escalation and you can find yourself in a conflict that could have been avoided.
Right. And worse yet, as you've observed here before, we might find ourselves opposing our friends in Israel and maybe even interfering in what they feel the need to do, given the circumstances they find themselves in at the moment. Victoria, so talk a little bit about your alternative approach that would give us a real Iran deal, if such a thing is possible with this particular regime.
Well, you know, the burden actually is on the regime to get a deal that would fix their systemic economic problems. There were reports this week that they're down to $4 billion in currency reserves, which is shocking. It's a number lower than Afghanistan, for example. And it points to the fact that the maximum pressure campaign was, and to many, to a large extent, is working. They are going to have to make some very difficult choices. Now, neither the much ballyhooed China deal nor any kind of Frankenstein JCPOA is going to solve those problems. It's not, the China deal isn't enough money. The JCPOA is...
When you say the China deal, you mean the deal between Iran and Chinese Communist Party?
Yes.
And neither that nor this Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA 2.0, would fix the magnitude of the economic problems that they're facing? Is that your point?
Yes, exactly. And the only way to fix them is for them to renounce hostility, which would allow for a comprehensive deal, which, as we've discussed, would be a whole range of address a whole range of issues, including economics. And that's the only way to fix it. And they're not doing it.
And there's no prospect that they're going to do it as long as they think they're about to be bailed out by the United States and or, you know, others that might importune, like the South Koreans recently, to give the mullahs money. And Victoria, then, if this pressure remains on, the sanctions do not come off in whole or in part, as some inside the Biden administration seem prepared to do, the pressure would then remain to make a better deal than the original one. But again, the conduct of the administration doesn't seem likely to induce the Iranian regime to think about making such concessions. In fact, they're talking now about enriching uranium to the 60% range, which is very close to what's needed for nuclear weapons purposes, no?
Well, yes. And I mean, I think we're back to the, as you said, bad old days of 2015, 2016 timeframe, when the mullahs got just enough financial relief to start funneling money into military programs, but did nothing to help the country. And that's why they're in such a bad spot now. You know, if they had invested wisely, the economic windfall of that time frame, they would be in a much better position now, but they didn't. They put it into the Houthi and Hezbollah and Iraq and Syria. And
Swiss bank accounts, I suspect.
And I think there was a lot of Swiss bank account activity, but that, you know, has resulted in, you know, just particularly after the Trump administration, just an economic meltdown. And, you know, it's not clear to me, even if they can, you know, white knuckle their way through the next couple of years, that ultimately they're going to be able to satisfy the Iranian people. And I would just raise the fact that they do have these presidential elections coming up in 8 weeks. And, you know, that is a very, very likely flashpoint. And it's going to be yet another kind of moment for choosing for this administration. You know, are they going to stand with the Iranian people, or, you know, are they going to stand with the mullahs?
They seem to have made that pretty clear. They're all in with the mullahocracy, as I call it. Victoria, in the remaining 2 minutes we have, very quickly, let me turn to something I know I'll be talking shortly about with Jim Carafano as well, but I'd like to get your take on it, given your role in the Trump administration. The president is going to announce today, after this taping and before the show airs, that we are withdrawing every one of our military personnel, apparently, other than those, I guess, protecting diplomats in Kabul, from Afghanistan, in time for the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. What do you make of this pronouncement, and how does it differ from what President Trump was doing?
Well, I think what we're seeing here is the triumph of the progressive left wing of the Democrat Party, who obviously wanted this to happen and pressured the president and the rest of the administration to make it happen. And, you know, we obviously wrestled mightily with the Afghanistan issue. You know, there is the very natural impulse and, you know, commendable impulse to want to bring our young men and women home if we don't have a clear strategy or a purpose for them to be furthering. And, you know, President Trump really agonized over this, for want of a better word, and ultimately made the decision that it was worth keeping reduced but still significant footprint in Afghanistan, for a whole host of reasons. But what this is an artificial timeline that's being dictated out of the White House and the EEOB, not out of you know, the military facts on the ground. And they've picked an attractive date, the 20th anniversary of 9/11, which is, I mean, yes, it's a weighty anniversary, but it's a random day, and that's what they're going to build their strategy on.
The symbolism may be more important to our enemies rather than to us. We have to leave it at that for the moment, Victoria. We'll talk, as I said, more about this with Jim in a second, but thank you for your time today and the great work that you are continuing to do for our country now with the Center for Security Policy. We'll talk with you again next week. Next up, James Carafano of the Heritage Foundation on Afghanistan, much more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to a friend and colleague of many years with whom I have not spoken in altogether too long a time. It's great to have him back. His name is James J. Carafano. He is the vice president at the Heritage Foundation's Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for National Security and Foreign Policy. He is a man of great renown for his experience both in the uniform of the United States Army as well as for the work that he's been doing for years now at the Heritage Foundation. He's the author of numerous pieces in the periodical literature, including Brutal War, book that I believe is required reading. We're just delighted to have him back. Jim, thank you very much for taking some time to join us again.
It's good to be with you.
Well, I'd like a guest to just sort of set the stage for this conversation by getting your perspective as a longtime national security practitioner, both in uniform and in the civilian side, as well as a close observer of administrations, past and present. How would you characterize the conduct of the Biden-Harris administration in the foreign and defense policy domain in its first nearly 100 days?
Yeah, well, I think the kind of two observations. One is, in practice, what we've seen is where the Biden team is actually followed most closely to the Trump administration, they've actually not done too bad. Where they've drifted the farthest from Trump's policies, they've actually encountered already, you know, disastrous trouble. The Middle East is a good example. The border is an obvious example. The reason for that's pretty simple. It's because Trump's policies weren't Republican, Democrat, isolationist, protectionist, or anything. They were realists. They were designed to deal with an era of great power competition, with the great dangers of the world, Islamic terrorism, Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, and they worked. So not surprising when Biden follows it more closely, he's seen more success. And when he's kind of cut loose from them, he's actually run into more trouble. The second observation is why are they doing what they're doing? And this, I think, is the real risk that Biden runs into is foreign policy and national security. These are not things for this administration. They're more like, you know, the chores that your parents made you do that you had to do, you know, because what you really want to do is go and play Nintendo. They are myopically focused, and they actually see foreign policy and national security as a distraction, myopically focused on a domestic agenda, which is really, really focused on the radical transformation of America. And is things that Obama could have only dreamed of, an election law that would completely federalize the election process and allow one political party to hold power forever, and investments that would just support every progressive agenda you'd ever want, growing government by 25%, massively increasing taxes and shifting the whole structure of U.S. society from the private sector to the public sector. And why are they doing that? Because they think they've got a window that because of COVID, they think Americans are so scared or frightened or whatever that they can ram through this agenda. And it doesn't matter what kind of price they pay or whether they get it right or wrong or whatever, because if they can successfully ram it through, they'll hold power forever. And literally Russia, China, North Korea, these are all distractions, and they try to deal with them as little as possible. But there are areas where they're so ideologically driven, like Iran and the border, where they've done these things, and actually all it's done is created enormous troubles and problems for them.
Let me ask you about a decision that, as we speak, is in the offing, the announcement thereof, at least, and when this program airs, it will have happened. The president is expected today to announce that we will be entirely out of Afghanistan, the military presence thereof, at least, by the anniversary of the September 11th attacks, the 20th anniversary. What are your thoughts about that, Jim, as a former career Army officer and, again, longtime observer of what's been going on in Afghanistan over all these years?
Well, I think the first thing I want to make clear is this is not Trump's strategy. I mean, it should be very clear. Trump's strategy was always conditions-based. Trump said, look, we don't need to leave troops anywhere in the world they don't need to be if they don't have to be there. And I think we all agree with that. That makes perfect sense. But we did have interests in Afghanistan. We want the region to be stable so India can really focus on dealing with China. We don't want a resurgence of a sanctuary for transnational terrorism, which could take us back to the days of 9/11. So those are important reasons to kind of get Afghanistan right. And so Trump's strategy was always when the conditions have achieved that look after our interests, we can safely withdraw all troops. It's not a problem. That's not what Biden is doing. Biden said, oh, conditions based is just a, you know, excuse to be there forever. We're just going to pull the troops out. This actually greatly reminds me of Obama strategies. I mean, this was the Obama's thing in Syria and Iraq. We're just going to pull out and we'll just see what happens. It's like, we're just going to take the safety net away and hope things don't go south. I mean, this, he did this in Iraq, he did it in Syria, he did it in Libya, and in every case, it blew up in his face. So
And I think it's fair to say that Joe Biden was an advocate for doing that in every case, was he not?
Yeah. When we bring the troops home, we're all for that. But the other question is, okay, fine. What is your plan to safeguard U.S. interests going forward? Because that's what we all want to hear, because that's why their troops were there to begin with. And so just saying we're bringing the troops home and picking this date of September 11th, which I think looks pretty hokey and actually kind of embarrassing that we're going to do it by that, as if, you know, but we want to hear, how are you going to safeguard our interests? Because that's what our troops are there and doing. And just bringing them home and failing to protect our interests, that's actually an insult to their service and the sacrifice and the tragedy of 9/11, in my opinion.
And I'm afraid an incentive to the Taliban to come back for more, alas. And I just have to say, Jim, the idea that we're going to give them two victories on 9/11 seems to me to be symbolically a very bad idea, as well as substantively. Lastly, let me turn quickly to something you touched on a moment ago, Jim. You've written about seven steps that we should be taking with respect to the border that are not being taken currently and are creating, as you indicated, potential for tremendous problems. Well, I think some of them are upon us already, but much worse is to come, I'm afraid, unless there's a course correction.
Well, we should be clear that the border is truly a crisis. So we're at pace to probably increase the illegal population in the United States by 2 million people by the end of the year at this pace, and all the extraordinary costs and burdens on the American taxpayer that come with that. You're fueling the cartels at the pace of $14 million a day, which all money that goes to China to buy the precursors to make fentanyl. So you're flooding the country with opioids and destroying American communities and lives. And of course, they're burning through money at an unbelievable rate. And actually, if you look at the president's budget, it's you're just gobsmacked, because the increase for the Department of Homeland Security is like a quarter of inflation. So they're going to actually lose buying power, while the rest of the government, except for defense, gets like a 14% increase in discretionary spending. So they're just going to bankrupt the Department of Homeland Security in addition to not securing the border. So completely a crisis. And as you might not be surprised, the answer is actually just go back. When you go through the list, it's going back to the policies of the last administration. Let me just highlight one just super quickly, which is remain in Mexico. You know, Biden said remain in Mexico is inhumane. Oh, we're terrible people. You know, we're not. That's not true at all. What remain in Mexico did, this idea that if you make an asylum claim or refugee claim to come to the United States, you make that claim and you wait at the border and we'll process that claim. And if it's valid, we'll let you in. Now, what was good about that is it literally weeded out all the meritless claims. And actually, it was much more humanitarian, because it actually allowed you to get to the people that really needed help faster. And so typically in the U.S., we approve about 20 and 30% of the refugee asylum claims. That's all over the world, right? On the border, the approval rate was about 1 or 2%. Now, it doesn't mean because we were harsher to people on the border, because the same people that adjudicated all these things are the people that did it on the border. What it meant was that 98% of those claims are meritless. And in Remain in Mexico, a lot of those people just went home, because they're just economic immigrants. They weren't real asylum seekers. So people don't talk about this, Trump actually processed in his presidency a record number of claims. And by just letting these people in, Biden is actually creating more incentives for illegal migration, creating huge loopholes for the cartels to exploit. It's a much more inhumane system, because you can't actually help the people you need to help. So the word disaster is not too strong. If you went back to remain in Mexico, that loophole would dry up overnight.
In your judgment, can we go back? Has the government of Mexico now essentially accommodated itself to the Obama policy of the past, and is unlikely to be willing, especially in the absence of the kind of pressure that Trump brought to bear, notably with the tariffs?
I think Central America liked Trump's policies better than Obama's policies, because it made less problem for them. Remember, under Trump, right, you didn't have many tens of thousands of people, most of them carrying COVID, running back and forth across our countries, making your problem of dealing with COVID worse. You weren't pouring money into the cartels, making your country ungovernable. You didn't have all the attendant problems of illegal migration traipsing back and forth the countries. So yeah, I actually kind of think they'd love to go back to Trump's, the good old days of Donald Trump, if they could get away with it.
So again, this leitmotif that if we simply revert to those commonsensical policies in each of these areas, our national security will be strengthened, and that of other nations who look to us to help them with security matters will as well. It seems to be an eminently sensible prescription. Jim Carafano, I'm not holding my breath that it will be embraced by this administration, but who knows? They may find that the disasters that they're inviting are going to require that.
You know, Biden said he wants to address the root causes of the problem. That won't take long, because the root cause of the problem
is him.
Is Biden.
Well said. Jim Carafano, we have to let you go. Thank you very much for your time today and the great work you do at the Heritage Foundation. Come back to us again soon. It's been really important to have you.
Yeah, God bless you for what you do and your show, and thanks for having me on.
Thank you, sir. Next up, Gordon Chang talks China right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to one of our regulars here, I'm proud to say, at Secure Freedom Radio, Gordon Chang. He is one of our country's preeminent experts on China, certainly one of the most clear-eyed about the threat that it poses to all of us under the Chinese Communist Party's misrule. And he has spoken to these issues prolifically in a variety of outlets, notably in several best-selling books, including The Coming Collapse of China, as well as in Fox News and various periodic journals, Newsweek among them. He is a good friend of this program. We're proud to have him with us and to encourage you all to follow him as I do at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, it's good to have you with us as always. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Frank.
A lot going on in your portfolio, my friend. Let's start with what China is doing, seemingly inexorably, to ratchet up its threat to Taiwan.
Well, there have been almost daily incursions into Taiwan's air defense identification zone, and the recent ones have been the largest. Also, China's first aircraft carrier, the Liaoning, exercises on the east side of Taiwan, encircling the island republic. And just after 25 planes entered Taiwan's air defense identification zone on Monday, the Global Times, which is Communist Party media, threatened to fly a plane over the island itself. That, of course, would be an act of war, extremely provocative. These are dangerous times, Frank.
Do you think, Gordon, that the Chinese are reading the Biden administration as either acquiescent to what they're doing or, well, prepared to look the other way as they engage in such behavior?
I think what they're doing is testing the Biden administration. One of the things that Biden has done on the China portfolio, Taiwan has actually been at the top of the list, I think, of the things that he's been doing well. Right now, the Theodore Roosevelt Carrier Strike Group is in the South China Sea. We see increasing tempo of U.S. Navy operations around Taiwan. That is important. Now, I don't think what President Biden is doing is sufficient. And I think Beijing is thinking it can actually engage in even more provocative behavior without consequence. But this is something where I think the administration is catching up to the situation. But one thing, I don't think anyone can handle this well right now, because China looks like it's on the warpath. I think they're bluffing, but nonetheless, this is a point where their provocative actions can have real consequences that can be uncontrollable.
Miscalculation is always a problem in these situations, and the danger of people misreading what they're doing or responding to it in a way that's unexpected can translate into, well, needless conflict. And Gordon, we appreciate your keeping a close eye on it and reporting in with us about it as well. Let me turn to another piece of the China portfolio, Gordon, on the other side of the world. China has, of course, embraced and, I guess, really entered into a strategic alliance with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Talk a little bit about the character of that relationship at the moment and what it might mean, perhaps, for other miscalculations that could result in needless conflict.
Foreign Minister Wang Yi signed a 25-year strategic partnership with his Iranian counterpart in Tehran. This is fascinating, Frank. In the past, China and Iran have announced all sorts of arrangements, many of them called strategic, and they really haven't come to anything. But this strategic partnership has been in discussion since 2016, so the timing is significant. I think that it is meant to be really a signal to the Biden administration that China can do whatever it wants, and really testing Washington to see if there will be a response. So I think that although this could very well be just symbolism, it's important symbolism, and it is a test of Biden. And the other thing right now, Frank, and it's not just Iran, it's not just Taiwan, we have Russian forces massing on the Ukraine border. I think Moscow and Beijing are actually acting in coordination. So everything that China does is a test of Biden and the international community.
I want to come to that in a moment, Gordon, but very quickly, in terms of whether there's more, you know, symbolism to this particular set of agreements or they're going to amount to something, I understand that the Chinese have begun actually deploying troops to Iran, as well as intelligence capabilities. Are you seeing any sign of that, Gordon?
There have been a number of reports that that is the case, and we shouldn't be surprised because China, as just a matter of its playbook, does insert People's Liberation Army personnel often surreptitiously. So I wouldn't be surprised. And this comes at a time, of course, when the Biden administration is thinking of reviving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is the Iran nuclear deal. So it is really hard to figure out what China is doing right now. But we can say one thing, and that it is signaling its support for the atomic ayatollahs and making life difficult for the United States.
And perhaps for Israel as well. We'll be talking about that momentarily at greater length with Victoria Coates. But I wanted to get your read on this, Gordon. Gordon, let me come back to something you touched on a moment ago, the possibility that we may see coordinated action between China and its friends, including perhaps Iran, but also Russia. We're worrying about Russian actions that are similar to those that the Chinese are taking, of a very belligerent kind, vis-a-vis Ukraine. Are you anticipating that if China does go for it in Taiwan, we would simultaneously see the Russians and maybe the Iranians, who knows, the North Koreans behaving badly, shall we say, as well?
Definitely, Frank. I actually think it's more likely that the Russians will move first and then the Chinese will take advantage of that. There was a hint of this in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis when China provoked the Sino-Indian War. So China always tries to take advantage of the situation, and they're certainly going to use proxies like Iran and North Korea for this. So that's the reason why both ends of Asia could be embroiled in conflict very soon. And we've got to be very concerned that although, you know, we've heard some resolute statements out of the administration, they clearly are insufficient considering the dangers that we face right now. I don't think there's an appreciation of that in Washington at this moment.
I fear not either, nor perhaps even the magnitude of the contempt that is being expressed towards the Biden-Harris administration, both by Beijing and by the Kremlin. It's another ominous indicator, I'm afraid, of a willingness to act in the perception that they can do so with impunity. Gordon, you've written a book about South Korea entitled Losing South Korea. You're going to be testifying tomorrow about some of the Moon Jae-in regime's abuses of human rights before the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. I'd be very interested in your thoughts about the upshot and the import of mayoral elections that took place recently in Seoul and in Busan.
Yeah, the conservatives crushed the ruling party, the Democratic Party of Korea, in Seoul and Busan. And I think people were more or less expecting that the Democratic Party would lose. But probably the margin took people by surprise. This is important because the mayor of Seoul is critical, especially because next year is going to be presidential elections. Moon Jae-in can't run again, but if his party called Minju had actually succeeded in Seoul, it really would have given a push for another progressive president. So right now, I think people are very happy about this. I actually don't. North Korea policy played a part in the elections, but really it was Moon's economic mismanagement, especially high real estate prices, that was the motivating factor. Politics are local, and right now Moon's policies across the board are seen to be failing, not only the foreign ones with regard to North Korea, but also the domestic ones.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing for us, but I'm hoping that we'll translate into a repudiation of him more generally. Let me ask you about one other piece of this very dynamic environment. At the moment that we're seeing this kind of aggressive behavior from China, Gordon, we're having John Kerry dispatched as the first senior U.S. government official of the Biden-Harris administration to visit Beijing and China itself, presumably for the purpose of trying to promote cooperation with the Chinese on climate change, his nominal portfolio. Given how badly he performed as the Secretary of State, is this likely to do anything other than reinforce China's perceptions that the Biden team is, they're cat's paw?
I think that certainly China's just laughing when we send John Kerry to Beijing to talk about climate change, when they're threatening actions against Taiwan, the Philippines at Whitsun Reef, and engaging all sorts of provocative behavior with regard to other neighbors. John Kerry says climate is standalone, and I hope we take him at his word. The real danger here is that he makes concessions on national security issues in order to get what he believes is the most important element of our relations with China, and that is, as you point out, climate change. I don't think that he's going to make too much progress, But you never know, especially because China right now is playing a multidimensional game. Biden administration is basically trying to catch up and not doing a very good job of it across the board. So when Kerry goes to Beijing, we all got to be concerned about the future of our republic.
Amen. I fear it, again, will be signaling the idea that they don't need to worry about the United States and its opposition to their behavior in China in general and specifically towards Taiwan. Gordon, we're out of time for today. Thank you so much for giving us this great brief, and we'll look forward to doing so again with you next week. Meantime, stay well, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Kyle Scheidler about rioting once again in Minneapolis, Portland, and perhaps beyond. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and most especially to our guest, Kyle Scheidler. He is the director and senior analyst for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism at the Center for Security Policy. He is prodigiously skilled in matters involving these topics, terrorism, domestic terrorism, real domestic terrorism, that is taking place and that is in the offing. He is the author of periodic situation reports at the center's website, securefreedom.org, which I strongly commend to you all, including one that he has filed just the past day or so about the rioting that is now taking place, not only in Minneapolis, but in Portland, Oregon. And I'm anxious to get his take on who's responsible and what it portends. Kyle Scheidler, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Glad to be here.
I take it is not Donald Trump insurrectionists and white supremacist domestic terrorists that we've been hearing a lot about lately, particularly since January 6th, who are engaged in the streets of Minneapolis and Portland at the moment. Am I right in that?
Oh, well, it would not surprise you, Frank, to learn that, in fact, it is not being called an insurrection or any sort of thing of the kind. In fact, we had journalists yesterday who gave the mayor of Brooklyn Center, which is a suburb of Minneapolis, Minnesota, a very hard time because he used the word riot. Actually, I believe it was the police chief of police, but he used the word riot. And you had actual journalists yelling at him, saying, you can't call it a riot, call it a protest.
A mostly peaceful protest, right?
Yeah, it gives you an example of the kind of media coverage we have been getting of the ongoing violence that has continued despite the election, although media coverage of it has largely disappeared. So we had this riot, and it was a riot, that occurred in Brooklyn Center, Minneapolis, after a police fatal shooting April 11th. A 20-year-old man was shot and killed following a traffic stop, and rioting broke out almost immediately. I mean, it was very, very rapid. You had people flooding to the scene of the incident, very quickly protests, and then violence, which has just really become the pattern now after really any kind of police-involved shooting of this type. And it really has, I think, large part to do with the rhetoric that has been pushed by BLM and Antifa over the past year or so. That had really has people on a knife's edge.
But Kyle, it must be more than just rhetoric. Is there evidence that there's actual planning and organizing for these kinds of activities? And I'm concerned, of course, as I think you are as well, that we're witnessing this sort of on an ongoing basis, if I understand you correctly, but using any pretext that might present itself, including this very unfortunate event. But what is in prospect, of course, is the possibility, at least, that we may see an outcome from the trial of Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer accused of murdering George Floyd, that these groups, Antifa, Black Lives Matter, and others, are not going to approve of. And that may, again, if there is in fact more to it than just rhetoric, translate into a vastly bigger problem, might it not?
Well, that's true, Frank. The issue at hand, and what is so interesting about these incidents that spur up quickly, is it indicates to us just how quickly they can mobilize their network, they can spread word of where and when to attend events and protests and violence, right? So what they can do relatively spontaneously, and nothing is truly spontaneous, but they're very networked so that they can operate very quickly. So if they can do that overnight, what can they do if the date of an event is known well in advance, as it is, in the case of the trial? So when they have a situation like that, they have a lot more opportunity for planning, and things can get a lot worse. But an incident like this in Brooklyn Center shows us just how fast they can operate, how quickly networked they are, and their ability to put people in the streets relatively rapidly across the country. I mean, we saw sympathetic protests in a number of cities just a day later. So they can move very, very rapidly when they want to.
And Kyle, to the extent that these groups are Marxist and indeed revolutionary in character, are we facing the prospect that we're going to see a truly insurrectionary activity taking place across the United States in the foreseeable future?
Sure. Well, I mean, if you define it as the law does, seditious conspiracy, attacking government leaders or attacking government buildings, then what you have is already going on. It's been going on for months in Portland, where just over the weekend they tried to burn an ICE facility to the ground again. These are violence actually far exceeding what we saw on January 6th, the assailants in most cases are charged almost identically to the way that the January 6th assailants were charged. The difference, of course, is that these guys bail out of jail right away and the charges end up dropped because you have these very left-wing prosecutors that are just not enforcing the law. And it makes a big difference.
It certainly does. Which raises the question, Kyle, if indeed these are insurrectionists and they are seeking to overthrow the government of the United States, and they will be organized to create mayhem. And when we talk about violence, we're talking about not just rioting, but, as you say, attacks on federal buildings, looting of stores. People have been killed in many of these instances across the country over the past year or so, including, I guess, in the past few days. Where is the FBI that is seemingly very, very aggressively pursuing the January 6th events? Are they on top of this? Are they monitoring it? Are they penetrating these groups? Are they taking actions, as I would hope the Biden-Harris administration would be, to ensure that any such violent activity is nipped in the bud, let alone, you know, formally and fully prosecuted?
Well, you know, Frank, they can do this when they want to. We saw examples of that prior to the Republican convention. I want to say it was 2012, where the FBI did a very good job of breaking up anarchist violence that was scheduled. So this is possible when they want to. It is more challenging to target Antifa cells than it is to target these sort of white supremacist groups or other sorts of right-wing groups. And the reason it's more challenging is because Antifa is better organized, they're better trained, they're frankly more intelligent, and they have a wider ecosystem of support. When you target Antifa or you target BLM, you have to take on the entire left-wing ecosystem of legal support and bail funds and all of these instruments of power that have grown up around them to support their effort. And the right-wing extremists, they frankly don't have any of that. And so they make a pretty juicy target if you're a federal prosecutor or an FBI agent, because you can make an arrest. It's relatively easy to get these guys in stings because, frankly, they're not very smart. And all of that makes them a pretty juicy target that you can splash on a press release and get kudos from your boss back in D.C. You will not get kudos from your boss back in D.C. If you target the hard left and their supporters. So that's. There's a strong sense of politicization and what the Biden-Harris administration says that they want, which is they want white supremacists in press releases being charged for anything you can find. I mean, that's clearly what we see. And they're not interested in enforcing the law against Antifa. I mean, that's pretty apparent.
This is not only a palpable violation of the principle of equal justice under the law, but it really is an inducement, I have to think, Kyle, to those on the left to act aggressively, act violently, act murderously even, confident that if they aren't going to get off completely scot-free, it certainly won't be punished in the way that, as you've indicated, people of a different political stripe would be, especially under the direction of the Biden-Harris team. I know you'll be staying on this, Kyle, and we appreciate your visits with us to keep us posted on what is happening and what may be in the offing. I just pray that those in this administration are heeding your admonitions that if they don't want vastly worse things to eventuate on their watch here in the very near future, they better be acting differently than they are at the moment. We'll be looking to you for updates on that and more as well, Kyle. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.